I'm very happy to be talking to Richard Baker today in California. Richard is an artist, and his paintings are representational yet minimal. His subject matter has been described as fresh and uplifting, and I think that's a pretty good description. Like myself, Richard comes to his art practice on the back of a long and successful other career. In Richard's case, it's being a producer for film and TV. And he's also a talent manager. And none of this is in a small scale either. He currently manages the comedian Tim Allen, and he's produced films like the Santa Claus trilogy and long-running TV series like The Drew Carey Show and Last Man Standing. So, hello, Richard. It's very nice to be talking to you.
Hi, John. Nice to be on a show in Ireland.
Yeah. The wonders of technology. So let's start with your creative heroes. Like, who are they? Are they all artists?
Oh, interesting question. No, you know, of course, there are plenty of artists that I admire and love. Edward Hopper, Robert Bechtel, an LA artist named Kenton Nelson, are all favorites. But Eric Fischel, another artist I like. But what first inspired me was the concept of macroeconomic artists, people who use the whole world as a canvas, people like Walt Disney,
right,
who would, you know, create entire, not just film and television worlds, but physical creative worlds like Disneyland. These sorts of people have always impressed me, and a lot of the innovators, like Richard Branson, Elon Musk, you know, their creativity also inspires me.
Right. Yeah, I was watching the launch of that new Tesla car. I was only marveling at Elon Musk, as what a great specimen of humanity. such a decent fellow, you know, or seems like it anyway.
Well, you know, it's not like there haven't been car companies, you know, for the last over 100 years. But you know, people like Elon Musk, they just march to the beat of a different drummer
In
terms of the innovations. And these technologies exist. You know, nobody else. You would think General Motors or Mercedes-Benz might utilize them.
Yeah.
But no, it's Elon Musk.
Yeah. Just going back to Edward Hopper, what is it about Edward Hopper that you like?
Well, first and foremost is what I enjoy most about painting, which is light, sunlight. The pure celebration of sunlight and shadow and color. That's what I admire most in, you know, most of the painters and paintings that I enjoy, and what I enjoy most about my own work. The fact that he did architecture and figures, and there's a sense of alienation in his figures. That a lot of people comment on. That's not so much of the appeal as his treatment of light and how light affects objects.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I like him as well, but I've never really been able to put it in words why I like him. I just know I like him. So it's nice to hear you articulate it like that.
Well, one of my favorite quotes is from Edward Hopper, and it's one of the reasons that I'm reluctant to even try and describe the paintings that I do, because to some extent I agree with Hopper when he said, if I could describe my paintings in words, I would not need to paint them.
I can relate to that. Now, you describe your work as minimal realism. Can you explain what that means?
Yeah, people look at photos of my paintings and say, oh, that's a painting? I thought it was a photograph. There are people who paint in a photorealistic style, which is representational, far more detail than I put in a painting. I try and capture the likeness of the motifs that I'm painting, but I try and do it in as simple a way as possible. So if I'm doing a figure, I'll reduce the try and capture the figure, the person in the skin, in as little as three colors, sometimes two colors, three colors. If the tones are correct from a distance, it looks very representational, very realistic. If you look close up at my pictures, you'll see that they're small blocks of color that make up whatever it is that I'm painting. And that's what I try and do. I try and simplify what I'm seeing as much as possible to capture that likeness. So it's representational. It's not totally photographic. There's a little bit of impressionism in there. And sometimes I feel like there's some geometric abstraction to how I simplify the forms that I'm painting.
Right. Okay. Good.
So there are people who, when they paint a figure, they do underpainting, they do glazing, they paint more in a classic portrait style with very subtle gradations in skin texture and shadow. The Dutch masters, for example. First of all, I can't paint that way, but that's not the way I was taught to paint. I was taught to paint in a very specific by an artist named Rackstraw Downs when he was a young emerging artist and was teaching several classes at the University of Pennsylvania. He taught me to paint in a way I still paint today, which is a direct style of painting, where you lay the paint down, lay down a stroke. If it's not right, scrape it off with your palette knife and lay down another color. He didn't teach us any glazing or any underpainting. It was very, very direct and thick. He wanted the paint to flow off of the brush. No scrubbing into the canvas or anything like that. He wanted you to lay down a stroke, and if it wasn't right, scrape it off and lay down another color.
Right. And how do you get over the fat over lean thing? Are you worried about it cracking, 10 years down the track or anything if you put it on thick at the beginning?
Yeah, I've heard that fat over lean thing. I'm not exactly sure what it means.
Oh, sorry. It means that you put your if you put the paint down very thick at the beginning, and then paint thinner and thinner on top of that, the thick paint underneath will crack. It'll dry at a different speed, and it'll crack. The paintings will crack. You see those really old paintings and they're cracked. That's kind of a bit of aging, but
Yeah. Well, the fact that I don't do layers. I just have the one layer.
Yeah.
I'm looking at a little painting right now that I did over 40 years ago. And it has not cracked or it's dried a bit, but it looks pretty good.
Yeah, okay. That's a pretty wild name, isn't it? Rackstraw.
British fellow, really interesting guy. He was a English literature major, I believe, in college, and went to Yale School of Fine Arts. And I think he was mentored by the head of our fine arts department at the University of Pennsylvania, whose name was Neil Welliver, another very successful painter. And he was a fabulous. Rackstraw was to this day is a great painter, and he's
I've looked at his stuff. It's lovely.
Yeah, like yourself, he's written a lot about art. He's quite a scholar about art, but he was also a very inspiring teacher. He would read us passages of classic literature. Just to inspire us, in our painting class.
Yeah.
I just took this painting class on a lark, just not expecting to have any talent, but so that when I would go to galleries and museums in the future, that I'd be able to have some appreciation of the technological, of the technique that went into the paintings.
Yeah.
And was surprised to discover that I had some talent at it. In fact, Rackstraw once gave me the ultimate compliment when he told me he thought my eye for light and color might be better than Edward Hopper's, my hero.
You must have been on cloud nine for a week after that.
Well, it made me think hard about whether or not I should pursue painting as a career, but decided to pursue what I thought would be a bigger canvas and become a television producer instead.
Yeah.
So that's what I did for many years.
And did he ever tell you how his I was really fascinated by his name. Like, I've never heard anybody call Rackstraw before. In fact, like, I was thinking, if somebody, if a scriptwriter came into you and said, my lead character is called Rackstraw, whatever, you'd just say, that's just unbelievable. That's, no one's going to believe anyone's called that.
Well, I've never heard that name again either, and I never really asked him or inquired about the origin of the name, but it does sound pretty original. much like Rackstraw himself, he's a...
One of a kind.
I haven't seen him in 40 years, but he was quite a character.
So your work, you were just talking about it there. Your work in, let's call it showbiz, that would have been highly pressurized, and like in many ways, it would have been like a constant state of trying to manage chaos. And when I look at your paintings, there's a kind of stillness in them that I imagine would have been very handy in dealing with that kind of life and, managing chaos. Do you see your paintings as a kind of a representation of that kind of stillness?
I do like the stillness in my paintings. And, you're right that, that sense of calm was a contrast to my longtime career in the entertainment business, but it was also a great asset in that business because I was an artist's manager, represented a lot of performers, and that calmness, brought a sense of stability, to the relationship over the years, and it's been really useful. In the paintings, it's one of the things that I enjoy the most is there's a captured moment. There's a focus to it. There's a sense of time being frozen. There's a contemplative moment to it. Frequently, there's a sparseness to the work, a simplicity, and the overall effect of many of the pictures, I think, is very relaxing.
Yeah. It occurred to me that it's, the way people talk about going to their happy place, it's almost like you painted your happy place. Like I have this image of you, in the middle of, a TV, control room, and there's all sorts of mayhem going around, and you're, just in your head, you're almost in your paintings.
Yeah, well, I don't paint. The motifs that I paint are not those TV control rooms or film locations or. But you've picked up something. Most of the I refer to photographs, snapshot photographs that I take, and they're usually taken at times of leisure for me. So, yeah. So the motifs, are usually things I do for leisure, and when I'm relaxed and when I see an image and a lighting situation that impacts my eye in some way or my gut. Frequently, I will get a visceral reaction when I see a particular scenario, and I take a snapshot of that motif and try and recreate that visual experience. Later in the studio in a painting. But the subject matter as a result is frequently me at leisure, either hiking with my dog or in friends, on a pond in the Hamptons, in the wine country of California, taking a bike ride, going to a tennis tournament, golfing.
Yeah, there you don't see many golfing pictures, well, paintings.
That's another thing that I try to do is I try and do things that are different than other artists. There are some things that have struck me that I would have liked to have painted, but I said, well, there are other artists that I know that have mined that motif extensively,
right, yeah.
And so I'll let them, do that. I think it was Ed Ruscha who first did a Standard Oil gas station. Well, his gas stations catch my eye quite a bit, but that's been captured by other artists. But I agree. There's not many artists painting the beauty of golf courses.
Yeah.
And as a golfer, I'm frequently distracted by, you know, what I'm seeing out on the course. And that's my excuse for my high handicap.
Very good. Now, a lot of artists listen to this podcast, and they're always very interested in hearing about the working methods of other artists, which you've gone into a little bit. But how does the whole process go for you? You see something, you take a picture of it, and then you've got all these. Do you start from the photos, or how does it go?
I'll see something that strikes me visually. I'll take a snapshot with either my iPhone or a small point-and-shoot camera. I'll take many hundreds of pictures over a period of months and spend a lot of time sorting through the photos on my computer and deciding which ones are worthy of a painting. It's a lot of work that goes into a painting, and at the end of the day, it's either going to hang in my home or somebody else's home. And I think a picture should really warrant that kind of investment and have that kind of interest, not just to me, but possibly to other people. Who might want it to hang in their homes. So I spend many hours combing through the photos and deciding which, if any, are worthy of painting. I will say that artists throughout history have used available technology to assist them with their artwork.
Yeah,
there's a great documentary on Vermeer.
Tim's Vermeer,
Tim's Vermeer. Yeah. And somebody just told me about a new David Hockney book I'm looking for the name of. It's called Secret Knowledge that analyzes famous paintings throughout history and discusses what possible technologies that the artists might have used.
Yeah, yeah.
To help them with it. So, but it is a sensitive subject among some people. Not to me. To me, the final painting stands on its own, and either you like it or not.
Yeah.
And any kind of tools that you use to achieve that are just that. They're tools.
Yeah.
But because there is some sensitivity in among some people in the art world, I don't want to discuss a complete step by step, except to say that I do print the photographs and refer to them when I paint. I don't always do a literal translation. I always try and simplify images. I may enhance the light and the color, and I may exaggerate some of the shadows to add drama.
Right.
And as one of my former comedian clients used to say, I exaggerate to clarify.
Right. And you were saying you don't do any underpainting; it's just straight on.
Direct. Sometimes I will do wet on wet blending.
Right.
And sometimes I will drag the brush over two adjacent color areas to try and smooth the transition.
Okay. Do you do any little color studies beforehand or anything like that, or you just get straight into the main thing?
I get straight into the main thing.
The main thing, yeah.
And if it's not right, I either paint over it while it's still wet, because sometimes I can't scrape off all that paint, or I wet. Or I wait for it to dry and then paint a different tone.
That technique you were talking about of using like very few colors, but from a distance it looks quite representational. How do you sort of check that as you're going along? Like, do you just keep running back and forward, or do you have any, you know, look in mirrors or upside down or any of those kind of techniques to sort of check you're getting the effect you want?
I'm always amazed. Because paint when it's fresh and it's wet, sometimes it changes a bit when it dries.
Yeah.
So I may look at something later in the evening or the next day and see that it's the wrong color. But considering that I may spend days, weeks, or even months on a painting, I'm always amazed, and I think it's one of my few talents, that I have a really good sense for the lighting, the overall lighting of the colors in my painting, so that by the time I'm finished the painting, what essentially is an illusion works, and there's a consistency throughout the whole painting, that even though I may have been working on it in small pieces for weeks. I don't know what you were saying about, you know, lenses or turning things upside down. I don't do any of that stuff, but I think I just have a really good eye for, especially for the lighting quality.
Right.
In the paintings. And I also am proud of my colors. There are a lot of artists that I see who have far greater technical skills than I have, but I think have problems with the colors that they mix. I think their colors could be more attractive.
All right. Do you have a favorite color palette that you start off from?
I lay out the traditional colors that I learned, years ago in painting class. But in recent years, I've discovered a few new colors that I supplement the basic palette with, and then there's some specialty colors that I'll pull out, for special situations. But there are a couple of paints that I've discovered that, such as I don't even know how you pronounce it, but Cassel Earth Gray.
Okay.
That is, it could be Castle, I don't know, Cassel, that is, as well as Payne's Gray. These are two colors that I did not know back in art school that I find very useful.
All right. And what's do you have one, brush, palette knife, paint? Do you have one thing that you're like, oh, I love this, I just... without this.
Not one brush and not one palette knife, because there's a number of brushes that I gravitate towards, and I can interchange the palette knives. But I would say that one color that I mentioned just now, that
the castle gray,
castle earth gray,
earth gray.
I would find it hard to live without that one.
All right.
And I don't use any colors right out of the tube, so I'm not suggesting to anybody that they mix up castle earth and paint it on their canvas, but which I've never done. But I use it to take the edge off of the pure vibrant colors.
Yeah.
Just slightly take a fraction of that that brilliant color off, and give them a more natural appearance.
Right.
Or to slightly soften a pure titanium white, to not make it gray, but just not quite as brilliant as the out of the tube white would be.
Yeah. Very good. I've seen you describe your work as art that needs no explanation. How's that going for you?
Well, since you don't have any pictures on this, we have to do more explanation than I would prefer.
Maybe I should clarify my question. When I read that, I was like, all right, I totally relate to it. I was like, please don't ask me. I painted it. I didn't write a book. I painted it. So,
well,
if I wanted
it's
to.
Like, okay, well, all right, this is.
So you know, what my question is how are you going with, you know, trying to not have to talk about it? Not just to, I know you're going to talk about it here.
You know what? People want you to talk about your art. It's part of the gig. You know, they don't just want to see pictures from artists. They want to hear other people describe them in 3 and 4 syllable words, and they want to hear the artists say inspiring things about the work. Personally, even though I'm well educated, I don't understand a lot of what I read that other artists say in their artist statements and in describing their work. I call it art speak, I kind of have a bad attitude about it. I've never been fond of conceptual art. I understand that it has its place in the pantheon of art, but I don't think that for me, I don't prefer art to be an intellectual exercise.
Yeah.
I prefer it to be more of a sensual experience, and possibly the motifs might trigger some psychological reaction in the viewer as well. But I think it should be more of a sensual experience and less of an intellectual experience.
Yeah.
And that's what's behind me saying that my art doesn't need any explanation.
Please don't talk to the artist.
You have to play the game if you want to, you know, unless you don't want to leave your studio.
Yeah.
And part of it is, you know, trying to verbalize what it is you do and have those words inspire other people. I've made efforts in the last few years to try and, come up with artist statements, and I've had some things written about me, and I'm constantly refining that to the extent that, I have to talk about the work, but it really, to me, is if you look at my paintings, you should, if, you know, not everybody responds to them, but a lot of people do, you should admire the beautiful colors, the light, the dramatic shadows. And I think that the motifs are fun and contemporary and attractive.
Yeah.
So either you see those things and enjoy them, or you don't. Yeah, go look at walk down the hall and look at another painting.
yeah. No, I know. Yeah, I've kind of come to realize that it's actually more about participation for the person who's asking you about it. Because inside me, I'm going, well, look, I painted it because I can't describe it in words, and now you're asking me to describe it in words. But what I realized, I think anyway, is going on is that the painting part of it, because I'm so involved in it, I forget that too from the outside, that it's almost a kind of magical thing. If you can't draw and paint, to create a painting is borderline magic for somebody. So for them, the only really way they can get involved is through what they're used to, which is language. So they want to use what they know, and that's talking. So they want to in some way get involved in that magic by, you know, saying, oh, is it this or is it that, or did you mean this, because that's what I think it means, and, you know, was that is my theory about your picture the same as, you know, all those kind of stuff that, you know. I think it's more about participation from people.
You know, that's one of the neat things about art, is that people respond in different ways, and they can come up with their own stories about what they see in a painting, or why, or formal aspects of a painting that I wasn't even aware of as the artist. And that's great. I kind of respond to what I see at a gut level. Oh yeah, that gut level, that is, you know, educated, from having studied art history and having worked in the television motion picture business for many years, you know, I've got an educated eye that I'm responding at a gut level to things, but something strikes me and I want to paint it. Sometimes I understand it from just the color or the composition, or sometimes it could be a deep-seated psychological reaction that I don't even fully understand. But decide that's something I want to try and capture. And more often than not, other people respond to it as well, and that's really exciting to see, to feel that connection with other people, that they, you know, enjoy the same, but essentially a visual experience, you know, that I had some time ago.
Yeah. So film production is a very collaborative art form. So after years of working with other people, is there an element to your work as a painter now that's kind of in reaction to that, like wanting to work alone on something that's solely your creation from start to finish?
Good question. That's not why I do this. I mean, I've always wanted to paint. And I finally have time to do it. But it is, after working in a business that requires a lot of collaboration. If you're doing film or TV, there's in television, there are current executives from the studio and the network that are supervising every episode and business affairs executives that are looking at the legal stuff in the show and requiring changes. So it's very collaborative, and you get notes from a lot of different people. When I do a painting, I'll have internal arguments with myself. You know, should I use this color or that color? Should I delete something from the composition or should I include something in the composition? And at the end of the internal discussion, it's like, hey, this is my painting. I'm going to do it this way. And that's the end of the discussion. I get to be a benevolent dictator. That's not like that in film and television. You always have to answer to somebody else. There's always somebody else who has approval rights over you. Even if you're a big movie director, there's a studio investing a lot of money who will at some point tell you no.
Yeah. So you spent like a long time managing people who were the focus of attention, and now you're the focus of attention. How are you finding that?
It's interesting for several reasons. One, although I'm a creative guy, I'm also a business guy. And so for years, you know, I had to be the business guy behind the artists. And so to have my own creative skills recognized, and for people to actually want to hear my voice and not my client's voice, after many years of having that be in the background, that's really exciting for me. It's also given me greater insight into what I did for many years, because there's so many emerging actors and comedians that came to me for advice and help over the years. I now have greater empathy for them because I know what it feels like to be an emerging artist who, you know, is struggling to get your voice heard, and you know you have a talent and you're trying to figure out how you can get that talent exhibited. So I certainly know now what it, you know, what all those performers felt like early in their career when they came to me for help.
Yeah. It sounds like you'd almost wish you had a you to manage you, if you know what I mean.
I wish there was someone like that. Until then, I have to wear many hats. In addition to being the artist, I have to manage myself.
Yeah. A lot of artists suffer from imposter syndrome. Do you have it? And if you do, do you have any particular ways of dealing with it?
Where I try and copy somebody else's style or technique?
No. Where you feel like somebody is going to say, you're not really an artist.
Oh.
You know, someone is going to unmask you as an imposter.
You know, that could happen. I would not agree with it.
Okay.
I know what I do, you know, in front of the canvas. I've collected paintings for many years. I think I have what might very well be a totally unique style. and I think that I have a talent for light and color, and have very distinctive brushwork. So there are a lot of purists in the art field, but that could question aspects of my technique. But I know the work that I do, and I believe in the results, and I think there's a lot of distinctive aspects to what I do. So
It sounds like anyway. You don't have it. It sounds like you don't have it, because imposter syndrome is a very internal thing. It's kind of between yourself and yourself, really, because, you know, no one is going to say to you, you're not an artist, you know, but it's more of a feeling, you know, but it doesn't sound like you have it at all. So what's the most moving picture for you to make? What's been the most moving picture for you to make?
Let's see. I'm thinking, possibly my baseball painting of Derek Jeter of the New York Yankees visiting the Anaheim Angels Stadium. That's probably because of my profound love for the game of baseball that I felt that I was capturing in this painting.
Right.
The atmosphere of being in a baseball stadium. The lighting, the crowd, the players going through their rituals, are all things that I tried to capture in this painting, which happened to be a very popular painting.
Right. So you've been talking about your business, like your business experience. So from your years of experience at the business side of the entertainment industry, what's your take on the current art business model, which is in the process of changing? Like, do you think there's a better way to do it?
I don't know that I'm qualified to talk about it. I've had a couple of, you know, traditional shows in galleries. I'm not at all active in social media. This is about as active as I've I've ever been, talking to you on this podcast.
You're on the wild frontier here, yeah.
Talking to you on this podcast is as wild as I've gotten. But I know there are a lot of art fairs. I know there's a lot of stuff going on the web. I just don't know enough about the, you know, I'm trying to learn, but I don't know enough about the art business to comment on, changes in that.
Okay. What's the biggest challenge you're facing at the moment as an artist?
Selling paintings. If people just said that they didn't like my work, that would be fine. But most people tell me how much they love the work, and then they don't pull out their checkbooks and and buy the paintings.
Right.
It's really hard to sell a painting. Until you're an established artist who's generated auction prices and are considered to be of investment grade, it's really hard to sell a painting. And that's You know, I've only been doing it for a few years, and maybe it just takes a period of time. You know, I've been told by at least one gallery that people don't respond the first show, even if they like the work, they wait till the second show to possibly buy something. So I enjoy having shows and galleries. Having been in the entertainment business, I kind of am oriented towards shows.
Yeah.
And so I like working for a period of time and presenting a body of work in a public space like a gallery. But the galleries are businesses. They're like stores, you know. They have overhead. They need to sell a certain amount of paintings. The artists have to earn their keep. So I'd like to sell more paintings. I sold 4 paintings in my last show, and out of 11 that were on display, and I'd like to improve that in my next show this October at the Skidmore Gallery in Santa Monica, Los Angeles, California. self-gratuitous plug there.
Yeah, that's fine. You were talking about collecting art there. I know you're an art collector and you have been for many years. What are the biggest mistakes you see artists making when it comes to collectors?
I can only speak from my personal feelings, which may not represent other collectors. But personally, I see some very talented artists and artwork. With wonderful technique that I think is wasted on motifs that are not appealing and to me personally are not something that I would want to live with in my home every day.
Very diplomatically put.
So, once again, you know, people keep telling me, oh, you should create art with thoughts about selling it or, you know, any of those aspects. And, that's how I look at the art that I buy. You know, this is something that I want to be living with in my home. And, you know, in addition to whether or not it has other qualities, you know, the light color motif, form, composition, whatever that appeal to me.
Yeah.
Artists tend to paint their environments. And, yes, if your studio is in a, part of town that's not particularly attractive, that's the view outside your gallery window. Perhaps of tenements or dilapidated structures. Well, that might be a great painting, but is that something that I want to look at in my house every day?
Yeah.
Not to me personally. It could still be a brilliant piece of work, but so that's one of the filters that I try and apply to my, you know, when I'm deciding what to paint
is,
you know, I might like the color, I might like the lighting, I might even like the composition, but is this motif going to be appealing either for me or for somebody else to look at on a daily basis?
Yeah. And is there anything you think that artists could do to make it easier for collectors, apart from paint, you know, pictures that people can live with?
Well, I guess the only real answer to that is I think artists have to wear many hats. You need to study the art market. You have to go to galleries. You have to read literature. You have to see. You have to go to art fairs and see what art is selling and how it's being sold. And talk to collectors about their collections and try and get a feeling for what makes collectors tick. And yeah, that all that takes a lot of time and effort, but that's the only way to get an answer to that question.
Right. And this you were talking about your next show in October. Is that going to be similar stylistically, or you know, is it going to be a variation or same direction?
Yes to both of your questions. My style will be the same. Some people have already, who've seen the work in progress, have commented on an evolution in my style. I think my brushwork is getting to be a bit freer than it was. But the basic style will be the same. There'll be some similar motifs and some new motifs. You know, I don't just paint one thing. I paint a wide range of motifs, and they're always changing, but the style pretty much stays the same. I'm going to explore for this show slightly smaller paintings than many of the ones in the last show. And I'm very excited about the new batch of work, and I've already done about at least eight of the 12 paintings for the new show. I'm very excited about the new work, and I will add you to my email list and send you a digital brochure for the next show when it's available.
Yep, definitely. Okay, well, this is my last question. I ask this to everybody who comes on the podcast. If there's one thing you could pass on to future generations, what would it be?
To be able to enjoy the simple beauty, the simple visual beauty in our everyday lives that's often overlooked by people as they scurry about in their frantic day-to-day activities.
Very good. I concur. Now, normally at this stage, I say, you know, I'll ask, how can people find you? But you don't have anything. You don't have a website, and Instagram.
I do.
I don't know.
I have
you
a
do?
Website.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Okay. What's it called? When did you get that? You didn't get that, like, today, did you?
No, I did it before my last show, which was last October. But it's there's another artist with the same name as myself.
I know.
And he's also from the same city of Baltimore, Maryland, originally. So it's confusing. But my site is called richardbakerpaintings.com.
Okay. Right.
There's not a lot on it. There's a brief bio, there's four pictures, and there's a way to contact me. And it also lists my credits, including my current gallery, Skidmore Gallery, which also includes me in their website, has more pictures of my paintings and more information. Yeah. But I do have that website.
And are you on any social media?
None.
None.
People keep telling me to get on Facebook. I'm waiting for a compelling reason. I hear Instagram could be useful for artists. I need more of an education on that.
Right.
I do not tweet.
Okay.
I can
hear the birds tweeting behind you, though.
Okay. Unlike Donald Trump, I do not tweet.
Okay.
A former classmate of mine.
Donald Trump?
At the University of Pennsylvania.
Oh, okay. Very good. Well, that's a whole other episode, but we won't
get into that here.
We won't get into that now.
That's another podcast.
Yeah. Oh, probably not really. now that I think of it. Okay. And will you answer any questions if people have any questions for you in the comments?
Absolutely.
Great. Art-related questions, I should say. I don't ask any other... What's Tim Allen's favorite food? Right? I don't want any of those questions. But any art-related questions, yes.
Great.
Okay. Well, look, Richard, it's been really enjoyable chatting with you. I like your work. I think it's very good. Personally, it's got that quality of it sort of grabs my attention. It's subtle in that, you know, when I look at it first, it seems like you've seen everything, but then I find I keep going back to it, and the more I go back to it, the more I see, which is one of the kind of ways I know it's good for me. This is just my own version of it. So, and then the other thing is, I think it's really admirable that you, I mean, of course, I'm going to say this because it's very similar to myself, that you know, it's it requires courage to kind of go, okay, I'm going to do this thing that I've always wanted to do, which is paint, and I'm going to do it. And become vulnerable, like you were talking about when you suddenly, you know, could it relate to the young artists who came to you for advice. Now you're a young kind of artist too, and that requires courage, particularly when you're not young, or as young as you were anymore. So I think that's great. I think it's really inspiring, and I think more people that do that would be good. So, it's been lovely chatting with you, getting to know you a bit better, and I'm sure we'll chat some more in the future.
Thanks, John. It's been an interesting experience and relatively painless.
Well, that's good. That's what I got. That's what we aim for is, pain-free, as pain-free as possible. All right. Well, as I say, we'll probably talk again, but for now we'll say goodbye. So goodbye, Richard.
Thanks. Thanks for everybody for listening.
All right. Bye-bye.
I've never felt this good in my entire life. Make me some spaghetti.
We are the Argyle Pimps.